This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
Thanks for doing your part for the planet. And 90.1 KPFT Houston.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening. This is Jack Valinsky.
And Jennifer Renee.
And I'm Glenn Holt.
And Brian, I guess, is not here tonight. He's recovering from a weekend, I guess.
The total of our people.
Yeah, we're it's a little us. Bit slim. And, you know, we're always looking for new volunteers. And if you're interested, you can email me, jack@queervoices.org. Deborah's taking a sabbatical, and I hope she'll be back sometime in the future. And, of course, Joan is stuck in Iowa.
Yes. And she's going to speak to us tonight.
And, of course, J.D., who doesn't, you know, visit us too often.
He's right. Stuck in the woodlands.
But he does send us information, and he does supply us with some great music and many times interviews. In fact, he's going to do a little interview tonight.
It's funny. I think we've got more remote correspondents now.
Yes. We're all phoning it in.
We've got this big network operation. So tonight on the show, we're going to have on News Wrap from This Way Out the Connecticut Supreme Court decision that came out last week in favor of gay marriage in that state. Casey Davis, Too Long in Quantity to Spend Too Much Time in the Closet. It's really a celebration of her 88th birthday. And then in the second hour, the Montrose Counseling Center, did you know that October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month? I almost said that it was Domestic Violence Month, but it's Violence Awareness Month. And so Sally Huffer will be here to correct us on that. We have Michael, and I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Luongo, the editor of a book of gay travels in the Muslim world. Okay, now I don't know how you go about
that
doing that.
That should be very interesting.
Should be very interesting. And, of course, we have other segments from This Way Out, and Joan Devlin is going to be interviewing the guy about the gay travels in the Muslim world. So
that's definitely Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Yeah, pretty much. And so to lead things off this evening, we have Kristen Williams, and you're going to talk about the new Transgender Community Center.
That's it. Hi, this is Jennifer Renee. We're here in the studio with Kristen Williams, a director of the new Transgender Community Center. And that's not quite the name, is it?
Well, no. It's actually the organization that runs the Transgender Center is the Transgender Foundation of America. And this is a Transgender Foundation of America center located here in Houston.
Now, this is the first one?
Yes.
There's nothing else like this?
No, nothing. In fact, nothing like it in the entire world. It's the first and only one. Certainly, this is kind of, and the truth is, you know, we kind of got our inspiration from this, from Brenda Thomas. If you remember years back, gosh, it must have been around
She was around for, 30 years?
Yeah.
She was a transgender activist here in Houston, worked for the city.
That's right.
On AIDS awareness.
HIV.
Yes.
Yeah, and I had worked with her a lot over the years, and one of the things that she had always wanted and felt that was very necessary is some sort of a cultural center or a center for transgender people to be and to house their history and to access resources.
And so the community center or center has historical data on the transgender community. Now, is it just in Texas and Houston, or is it nationally?
Well, no, it's, gosh, we have all kinds of transgender history memorabilia going back actually thousands of years. And it's from almost every culture imaginable, from the Roman Empire all the way up to Christine Jorgensen. This includes statuary, coins, everything from postage stamps to original photographs of transgender people, like, let's see, Mary Edwards Walker. We have an original photograph of her. We have lots of very rare older books, personal letters from Christine Jorgensen, lots of different autographs. Just recently, I don't remember her name, but she is the first transgender politician ever elected in Japan, and she took it upon herself to send us a bunch of her information to be included in this archive.
That's wonderful. I guess one of the interesting things is that when you talk about the history and we go back thousands, I say we because I'm a trans too, is the fact that, if you didn't know, the fact is that we've been, despite what some people may say, we've actually been around for thousands of years.
Absolutely.
Yes, I'm sure in some cave somewhere there's some drawings. One of us probably did the drawings. And but what was the story behind this? I know you said that it was Brenda Steele, but there's got to be the backstage story behind this. And give us some of the information.
This being the first. Well, yes, and this is kind of some gossipy information, but I'll tell you.
Hey, just the two of us.
Just the two of us. Okay, so here's kind of the inside scoop on that. It was around the time that the whole NDA non-discrimination thing was.
That was November of last year.
Yes, and some people contacted me and a friend Carolyn, who has been active in the community for years as well, specifically in HIV, and they basically told us that they thought it was a rotten deal that the transgender folks get, and that we seem to get the short end of the stick all the time, no matter what. We can't get medical care. It's very difficult to find competent doctors who will work with us. Insurance companies won't pay for our medical care. We're excluded from almost all social services in the Houston, Harris County area. We can't, if we're homeless, there's no shelter who will, work with us, house us. And they thought, we would like to do something. And they came to us and suggested, can we do this? Mm-hmm. And, of course, I went, yes, of course. Sure, you bet. and out of that formed the Transgender Foundation of America. And what we would like to do is use Houston as kind of a laboratory, if you will, of empowering our community to help itself and to be its own stewards of its own history, to help itself through creating more groups, support groups, one transgender person helping another. Mm-hmm. So that's really what we would like to accomplish here in Houston, and it seems to be going very well.
I was noticing in some of the stuff, the groups that use the center as their meeting location, and HTGA, TATS, TG Social Group, STAG, Significant Others Support,
that's right.
TG Buddhist Group.
Yes.
TG Christian Group.
Yes.
All right. And then CAB, and then City of Houston's TG Task Force.
That's right. And that's brand new. That's the City of Houston decided that we needed a task force and approached me, several months ago, about working with the City of Houston to address HIV in the transgender community. Now, the thing with our community, what we believe is that the reason why the transgender community has such a high HIV infection rate isn't because, someone comes out as being transgender and all of a sudden they're going to acquire HIV. It's usually something to do. It's symptomatic of the way that our role in our culture and our society here in Houston We believe that the reason why we have a high HIV infection rate is because it is difficult to get HIV testing. It is difficult to find medical care. It's difficult to access social services, and there just seems to be, someone comes out as a transgender person. I have a great example of this. There was a young transgender person who was 19 and who was kicked out of her home for being transgender and had been taking hormones for a long, long time. Went to a social service agency for help, and that they refused her service, and no place would house her. And she, of course, at that point, before this happened, she was a non-smoker, didn't use drugs, didn't drink, and was a vegetarian. After this, none of those things were true anymore, and she had gone through the jail system a couple of times and had become HIV positive. Now, all of that was preventable had she been able to access care. So groups like this are very, very important, and we've seen them grow out of this center. When the city of Houston found out that the community was kind of getting its act together in this way, they thought that the time was very ripe to kind of move on this issue.
Well, one of the things, too, and I think for the people that are listening need to understand, is that many transgenders, it's very difficult. They can't get work. There's a whole set of prejudices that go along with it that are significant, even more so than just being gay or lesbian or bisexual. The trans community or a transgender person has a tendency to confront, not them personally, but it confronts the individual who
sure.
meets us, the employer, and so they don't want to hire us. And as a community, we have trouble getting jobs. We have trouble getting jobs. There's only so much we can do. And many of the young ones mm-hmm. in our community end up being sex workers.
That's right. That's
and then
exactly.
Where do they get the AIDS? It's from being sex workers.
That's right.
And they're sex workers because the society itself doesn't give us a chance. And there's a few of us, like you and I and some other people that we both know very well, that were able to make the transition and maintain jobs, some of them in their own careers that they had before.
Right. And, you know, it also goes a little bit deeper than that. And it there's issues of self-esteem and self-worth that is, you know, if that means sleeping with you without a condom, if you will like me, if you will hold me, those kinds of things, I'm willing to do that. And sometimes it's not strictly sex work. It's about if I sleep with you, if I continue sleeping with you, then I have some place to live.
Oh, yeah.
So,
and that's because there's no housing of any kind. If you're on the street, there's no place for you to go. You're kicked out of your home because you come out to your parents as being trans, and then suddenly you're on the street because there's no place, no one will take you in.
That's right. And one thing about this transgender community center, it's one of the, it's just a very, very nice place. And, gosh, if I had had something like this whenever I was coming out and my self-esteem was nothing, and I walked into a place that was this nice and I could access my own history as a human being immediately, it kind of confers an inherent value on a community member
mm-hmm.
to walk into a nice place and be treated nice and to have meetings that represent all segments of our community and that everyone is there to support one another. And that's one of the things that I've seen that has kind of been really nice is with all the groups in one place, I see that the groups are working together in a way that I've never seen before, which has been very nice and I think very positive for building a stronger community. And, I just One of the things that I really believe is, you know, we as a transgender community can't sit around on our hands and hope and just try to hope that somehow, some way, things will get better for us. We have to do it for ourselves.
Well, by creating a sense of community by all the groups in one spot, because I know in the past, being active in the community for 15 years now, that the truth is that we never had a single place where we could come. At some point, the GLBT Community Center was a resource, but prior to that, the transgender community, as well as its meetings, were somewhat outcast. Mm-hmm. It's only really been in the last number of years that the trans community is actually part of the gay and lesbian bisexual community.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, the whole purpose of having a transgender center is to deal with the issue of gender. We're so vulnerable. We have so many, well, issues that, you know, we felt that we needed to provide some specialized area so that people can come to receive specialized services, access specialized resources, and have a safe place where they know this is where I can go that represents me as a transgender individual. And again, this is, you know, a TFA center. This is where we're based out of, and this is where our offices are.
Now, I know you were talking earlier that this is sort of the start.
That's right.
And is there a long-term plan, I say long-term, over the next 5 years or so to expand into other cities?
Well, what we're doing right now is we're in the process of looking at how resources can be applied in the transgender community to produce the best outcomes. One of our thoughts right now is that we see that these centers seem to be helpful to the transgender community, accessing your history, having resources immediately available, and pulling the groups together, which really kind of ended all of the infighting like that. Are important, and so our thought is that we would like to expand and set up centers in other areas. In fact, I will be going to San Francisco in December to look at how feasible that is.
As a resource here in our community, does the center act as an advocate for the community with interacting with other service organizations?
Absolutely.
Like Montrose Counseling Center or some place, or the city of Houston, some of the other places where in the past they really haven't been open and accepting of transgenders.
Well, for instance, we on the Thursday night socials, we invite some of the HIV testing organizations in, and they provide free HIV testing on Thursday nights. For instance, one of the things that we feel is very important is to work within some of the different city groups and local groups to encourage some real change. Mm-hmm. For instance, very, very recently, the Houston Homeless Coalition just changed their standards of care to now include protections for transgender specifically.
Go ahead.
Which means that if someone is going to be accessing HUD funding for shelters, they will now have to provide care to transgender people.
Okay, we're about to run out of time, but I wanted to cover one other thing. First, give me your information. I've got one more question, but I want to go and get our information out twice.
Okay.
The location and website, phone numbers, that sort of thing.
The Transgender Center is located kind of in the heart of Montrose. It's on 713 Fargo, 713 like the area code, and Fargo like the movie without a wood chipper. Mm-hmm. And the phone number is 713 720-8586. That's 713-520-8586. And if you want to know more about the center, you can go to our website, which is tgctr.org.
Well, we've been speaking with Kristen Williams of the Transgender Foundation of America Center here in Houston, Texas, an advocacy location, as well as the Center for the Transgender Archives here in Houston. Thank you, Kristen.
Thank you.
And this is Queer Voices.
I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm Donna Ann Ward.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending October 11th, 2008. The Connecticut Supreme Court, in a 4-3 decision issued on October 10th, ruled that same-gender couples should be able to marry in the state. The majority said that even though civil unions for lesbi-gay couples have been available in Connecticut for about 3 years, granting virtually all the rights of marriage but the name, such a separate category violated the state constitution's guarantees of equal protection under the law. Justice Richard N. Palmer wrote for the majority that, because the institution of marriage carries with it a status and significance that the newly created classification of civil unions does not embody, the segregation of heterosexual and homosexual couples into separate institutions constitutes a cognizable harm. Melinda Tuhus filed this report from New Haven for Free Speech Radio News.
Connecticut legalized civil unions for same-sex couples in 2005, but many advocates have been pushing for the right to marry. Ann Stanback, director of Love Makes a Family, said this victory was 8 years in the making.
It is a historic ruling. I think that the court said very clearly that civil unions are a separate and unequal status, and I think people will be getting married before the end of this year, for sure.
The ruling in Kerrigan and Mock et al. Versus Department of Public Health came 17 months after the case was argued at the state Supreme Court. Connecticut joins Massachusetts and California as the only states allowing full marriage rights for same-sex couples. For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Haven.
The Boston-based gay and lesbian advocates and defenders filed the case in 2004 on behalf of 8 Connecticut same-gender couples after they were denied marriage licenses. That prompted the state legislature to pass a civil unions law the next year that was intended to satisfy marriage equality advocates. The lawsuit proceeded up the judicial ladder, however, as gay and lesbian couples continued to demand full marriage rights.
In one of 3 separate dissents, Justice Peter Zarella argued that any decision on same-gender marriage should be left to the legislature. Lawmakers, however, have been reluctant since passing the civil unions measure to take that step. State Attorney General Richard Blumenthal, whose office represented the state in the case, said the decision will take effect on October 28th and that it can't be appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court because the case involved the state constitution, not federal law. But there's a proposal on the November ballot asking voters whether or not the state should convene a constitutional convention to consider opening Connecticut to direct initiatives. Opponents of the court's marriage ruling support direct initiatives, which could enable them to put a constitutional marriage ban on the ballot. Peter Wolfgang of the Family Institute of Connecticut told reporters that Connecticut voters will have one opportunity on November 4th to reassert their right to self-government. We must vote yes. Meanwhile, the Iowa Supreme Court announced this week that it will hear arguments on December 9th in a case challenging that state's law banning same-gender marriage.
In California, earlier polls showed that Proposition 8 was losing. That November ballot measure would reverse the ruling issued by the state Supreme Court earlier this year and eliminate marriage equality for same-gender couples. TV and radio ads now running up and down the state by the better-funded proponents have changed the polling numbers. The ads argue that people could be sued for their personal beliefs, that the tax-exempt status of religious institutions would be endangered, and that young schoolchildren would be forced to learn about same-gender marriage. Lesbi-gay activists have called the claims in those ads outright lies. But the latest polls now show Proposition 8 favored by 47% of likely voters, with about 42% opposed. Major support for Proposition 8 has come from the U.S.-based Roman Catholic fraternal organization, Knights of Columbus, the rabidly anti-LGBT Focus on the Family, and several well-heeled members of the Mormon Church. While supposedly neutral in political matters, Mormon elders made a televised appeal to followers gathered at church buildings in California, Utah, Hawaii, and Idaho, urging them to work for the passage of Proposition 8. Voters in Arizona will also decide on a state constitutional amendment to ban same-gender marriage on November 4th.
The latest polls in Florida also show increasing support for a state constitutional amendment there that would not only ban same-gender marriage, but specify that no other legal union that is treated as marriage or the substantial equivalent thereof shall be valid or recognized. Opponents say such language would also prohibit civil unions or domestic partnerships, not only for lesbi-gay couples, but for unmarried heterosexual couples who live together but choose not to marry. Domestic partnerships are also favored by senior citizens, a major voting bloc in the state, who would lose government benefits by remarrying. Amending the state constitution requires a 60% vote in Florida, but recent polls show support for the ballot proposal has grown to 55%.
Elsewhere, Portugal's parliament this week voted by a large majority against a bill to allow gay and lesbian couples in the predominantly Roman Catholic country to marry. Prime Minister José Sócrates of the ruling Socialist Party had warned last week that such legislation was not on the government's agenda. Two minor leftist parties sponsored the civil marriage measure, but only 28 members in the 230-seat legislature voted for it.
Marriage equality for lesbi-gay couples will become legal in Norway on January 1st. But bishops of the Church of Norway voted this week against allowing pastors to perform weddings for those couples. The Lutheran denomination counts nearly 85% of the country's population as members. After what were reportedly hours of heated debate, bishops decided to allow pastors to recite a prayer for civilly married gay and lesbian couples, as long as it's not a formal blessing ceremony.
About 40 anti-gay Anglican church bishops from Africa, Australia, the U.S., India, and Canada took part in a conference last week near the Uganda capital of Kampala. It was a follow-up to a conference held in Jerusalem earlier this year by church traditionalists who oppose openly gay Anglican bishops, specifically Episcopalian Gene Robinson of New Hampshire, and the blessing of same-gender couples conducted primarily by Anglican clergy in North America. Bishops, other clergy, and laypeople from the Global South, Africa, Asia, and Latin America, formed what they called a church within a church in Jerusalem, saying that while they don't want to leave the global Anglican communion, they oppose its liberal wing and must act separately to support traditional biblical teaching against homosexuality. A bishop from southern India told reporters that, "We need to explain to those who disagree with us on the issue of taking the authority of the Bible as we do."
Uganda's leading Muslim cleric called last year for gay people to be rounded up and marooned on an island in Lake Victoria until they die. And the government of Uganda announced this week that they intend to strengthen the country's laws against homosexuality. Ethics and Integrity Minister James Butoro told a news conference that the state of moral health in our nation is challenging, and we are concerned about the mushrooming of lesbianism and homosexuality. Who is going to occupy Uganda 20 years from now if we all become homosexuals? We know that homosexuals don't reproduce. He blamed increasing globalization, charging that 10 years ago, this phenomenon was not here, but the disease has penetrated everywhere. Consensual adult same-gender sex is already outlawed in the East African country, punishable by up to life in prison. LGBT activists held a first-ever press conference in Kampala a year ago to demand basic civil rights. Fearing reprisals, many wore disguises. A coalition of Christian and Muslim groups filled a downtown stadium a week later, demanding the arrests of all gay people. Ugandan LGBT activists have been increasingly targeted by police for detention and abuse since then. Butoro said that new legislation would be introduced to prosecute anyone who simply comes out publicly as lesbian or gay.
But an estimated 10,000 LGBT people and their supporters came out for the 19th annual Pride festivities in Johannesburg, South Africa on October 4th. According to local media reports, 32 floats and many equally colorful marchers wound their way down the parade route to a multi-stage performance space featuring well-known DJs and drag entertainers. Love, Not Hate was the overall theme this year, focusing on the troubling rise in anti-LGBT hate violence. While sexual orientation discrimination was outlawed in the country's post-apartheid constitution and marriage equality was established there in 2006, a number of black lesbians have been brutally murdered in the townships in recent months.
And finally, famous Italian comic Sabina Guzzanti will not be prosecuted for saying in July that Pope Benedict XVI will go to hell for the Roman Catholic Church's treatment of gay people. Justice Minister Angelino Alfano decided not to launch a formal investigation. A local prosecutor in Rome had charged that Guzzanti's comments broke a law that protects the dignity of the church. A Vatican spokesman said that the church approved of the decision to drop the matter.
That's News Wrap for the week ending October 11th, 2008, written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Donna Ann Ward.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
Coming up next on Queer Voices, Jack Walensky talks with Casey Davis about her 88 years in the gay community. From their 2007 CD, In With, that was Ex-Boyfriends, had a track called Situation.
This is Queer Voices.
With us this evening is somebody I've known for a long time, but then I don't know a lot about her. Casey Davis has been a resident in Houston for how long?
Since 1985.
Wow.
Shortly after my 65th birthday.
And now you're celebrating your 88th birthday?
88th. I celebrated it some time ago.
And you look fabulous.
And when Deborah mentioned to me, or when Deborah heard me mention that I shared a birthday with Mahatma Gandhi, she asked if I would spend some time on this program. Well, that I don't know whether I could deal very much with that subject. So maybe it's better that I do it on the Monday after coming out day.
Okay. Well, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, before puberty, my life was pretty uneventful, except that I do remember the kindergarten teacher telling me that I shouldn't skip with the girls anymore. I should gallop with the boys because I hadn't learned how to skip, and I had learned how to gallop. And
where were you brought up?
Well, that was in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Okay.
And then my mom mentioned that I had an awkward walk. Well, that was not very helpful, you know.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
Yes, I had an older sister and an older brother. Also a younger brother who died in childhood. We could go into that another time. I would say the first time that there was some conflict with my mom, it was because I was staying after school to help my sixth grade teacher fix her room up and everything. And I thought my mom was concerned that Sister Petronilla was replacing her as my mother.
Okay, yeah.
Also about that time, I had gone to Girl Scout camp two summers in a row and had fallen in love with the counselors and like that. And I would talk about it quite freely, you know. And my mother at the time was taking a college course from Sister Catherine, a Benedictine nun there in Duluth. We were in Duluth, Minnesota by that time. And she was all sold on Freudian psychology. So I could tell from hearing my mother's end of the conversation on the phone that this nun was telling her, well, this is a passing phase. This is something that all girls go through. Don't worry about it. She'll come out of it. And somehow I never did come out of it, because I would go to the skating rink, which was something that every boy and girl in Duluth did during the winter. You went to the skating rink, and if you were a boy, you managed to pick up a girl, probably. And I would sit there and wish that I could flirt with the boys the way Catherine Devney was flirting with my brother. Well, I never got the knack of it. So,
did you feel there was something wrong?
No, I can't say how I felt about it all. I was trying to find out what I needed to know to get the knack. And I finally decided that nobody wanted me, so maybe God wanted me. So I joined the Benedictine nuns in Oregon. I was in Oregon by that time. And I always kind of befriended the girls who were obviously the same kind of a girl as I had been, but the nuns looking down upon me and judging me would think I was in love with these girls, which I was not. But I was just trying to look after them and make their life a little less unpleasant, you know, unfulfilling. Except that, of course, there were girls there that the nuns fell in love with and didn't object to the other girls calling this girl Johnny and stuff like that. It was strange. I didn't know. Oh, one other thing about my childhood was that what we did at school, we had two recesses in mid-morning and mid-afternoon at St. Anthony's, and then anybody that lived close enough to the school would have time to come back to the school and play during the lunch hour. And the girls' favorite occupation was skipping rope, not individually, but two girls swinging a rope and other girls going through certain routines in it. I was afraid to try anything, except I became a very good rope swinger. But I was afraid to try jumping rope. I just didn't feel I would somehow have whatever it took.
Did you have friends? Did you have friends?
Yeah. I had some friends. But and I just kind of struggled my way through life, through being a nun, and then they suddenly discovered that I had enough college credits, besides my teaching duties, to go off to St. Louis and get a master's degree in something that had to do with English and education. And I experienced something more than love at first sight. It was love before first sight. As I walked through the storeroom in this house of studies that was arranged for nuns, you know, to protect them from whatever they needed to be protected from, I read this neatly lettered label on a trunk there. And it said, Sister Julia Rice, St. John's Hospital. I forget the street address, but it said, golly, I don't even remember the whole of it now. But anyway, I felt a thrill go through me just reading that. And I knew that this was going to be very significant in my life, which it was. And everybody knew what was happening, or at least thought they knew what was happening, because what they knew was happening was a whole lot more than the relationship between us. We were having what they would have called an affair, I would say more accurately would be described as a quite chaste courtship.
And did you feel that this was wrong? Or
no, I just felt that this is something I have needed and I am grabbing it.
Okay.
And of course everybody knew, and they were, my companion there was writing back to the superior, and the superior was eager to get to St. Louis to do some studying for her doctor's degree on her own and find out what this deal was about. In fact, she seemed to convert Julie when Julie came back from visiting with her fellow Dominican nuns in Colorado. She was totally converted to the idea that she had committed the ultimate sin, and I don't think the nun that converted her ever did know what happened to her, because she went back to New York City, left the Dominicans, and joined some group of nuns that were working with the poorest of the poor in some southern state. And she kept up a correspondence with me, especially now that the superiors weren't reading every word that went back and forth between a member of the so-called community and somebody on the outside. And then I didn't hear from Julie for a long time. And then I heard from somebody that wasn't Julie, but said that that Julie had asked her to write and tell me what had happened. And what had happened was that a young man was chauffeuring like a half a dozen nuns of this group home from something that they had gone to in the evening. And the car stalled on a railroad track, and the car was hit, dragged for several yards, turned over, and everybody but Julie was declared dead at the scene. And Julie had burns over more than two-thirds of her body, and she wanted me to know what had happened. And I never shared that with anyone for years and years and years. Anyway, of course, I was pretty much pushed out of the life that I was trying to resume, because I figured I figured being a nun was a good thing. As long if it was satisfying enough that sex was not important in your life. Okay?
We're talking to Casey Davis, who's celebrating her 80th birthday.
88th.
88th, yes.
Oh, it sounded like 80th to me, and I did want to emphasize it's 88. Well, I was expected to knuckle under to this nun who had sort of eased this information out of Julie. And I didn't, I was not about to knuckle under. So I left there and found a job that would just keep a roof over my head and keep food on the table, and went on from there. I was pretty soon I was working for Portland Public Schools in Portland, Oregon, at top of teacher's wage scale. And I went on for a PhD in school psychology. And I call myself now an AABD. An AA an AABD is all an ABD is an all but dissertation, which I had finished. Well, I hadn't quite got to that, so I called myself an AABD and decided it wasn't worth it. I was trying to take care of my mother's problems at the time and my dad's problems. And that was, it just couldn't be worked in. And then I started putting things together, like remembering things that I had long forgotten. For instance, you know, looking across the coal stove that was in this warming house at the skating rink and watching Catherine Devney flirting with my brother. And I remembered other things. I started remembering things that I had long forgotten. And I was taking some work at Chemeketa Community College in Salem, Oregon. And they had some kind of a spring celebration where different classes. Am I taking up too much time?
We have about 2 minutes left.
2 minutes left.
Yes.
I'll be through pretty soon.
Okay. It's not that you're very interesting.
Well, anyway, part of this celebration was watching a dance class perform. Well, the dance class consisted of, I think, several women and one man. And the man was marvelous dancer. But what was I watching? I was watching these little round bodies that were dancing well, but they weren't the star of this. So I finally put it all together. And once I had put it together, like, this is why I say, too long in a quandary to spend any time in a closet. I had been in a quandary all of my life up to, say, about 60 years. And when I had it figured out, it came as clear as can be. And the first person I came out to was the pastor of the Methodist church that I was going to at the time.
But you didn't have the community back then to really be able to relate. Am I correct? You know, like now we have, you know, the communities in big cities, and, you know, there's books and the internet and all that stuff that you didn't have the access to.
See, I think one thing that followed up my life was when we moved from Minnesota to Oregon, my dad, of course, wanted me to get into college right after my high school graduation back in Minnesota. And I think my best bet for that would have been Oregon State. I mean, money-wise and social relations-wise.
Well, we're going to have to stop it from here, but we'll continue this conversation.
We'll take that up another day.
Another time, yes. I appreciate you coming coming by and talking to us. And, you know, I know you've been in Houston, you know, you told me since like 1982 or
85.
So you lived here a long time, but it certainly has been a journey, hasn't it?
It has. And when I came to Houston, I found the Gay Political Caucus and was active in that. And from being active in that, I was active in some other things, AIDS, volunteering, and whatever.
Well, Casey, thank you for joining us, and you're listening to Queer Voices.
It was a joy.
I'd love you to tell me about power tools.
Well, I've got several people in my life who have this affinity for hardware stores and power tools, and my manager is one of them. She always has some kind of a tool on her Christmas list, and we always have to have her cut a picture of one out so that we know what she's talking about. We went up to this gig in Alaska. They've got like the world's largest hardware store up there. She almost went into a coma. It was unbelievable. But got back, talked to our hardware store, who were sort of upset with us, sort of like we cheated on them. We went to a different hardware store. And they said, you know, you don't have any hardware songs. And I thought, oh, well, old dopey me, what have I been writing about? But came up with that, and I kind of thought that Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend needed to be rewritten anyway, so it was a good use of it.
A kiss on the hand may be quite long in coming. Power tools are a girl's best friend. kiss may be grand, but it won't fix the plumbing in your humble flat, or help install a second bath. Boys get weird as girls appear with their tool belts and drills in their hands. Cordless screwdrivers, jigsaws and miners, power tools are a girl's best friend. Like recessive jeans, this will show up for certain. Power tools are a girl's best friend. It all seems routine, maybe hanging a curtain, and this simple chore will send her to a hardware store, lumber yards, Knox, Menards, and you'll find that the search never ends. Pneumatic hammers and orbital sanders, power tools are a girl's best friend. Menards, and you'll find that the search never ends. Pneumatic hammers and orbital sanders, power tools are a girl's best friend. A kiss on the hand may be quite long in coming. Power tools are a girl's best friend. A kiss may be grand, but it won't fix the plumbing in your humble flat, or help install a second bath. Boys get weird as girls appear with their tool belts and drills in their hands. Cordless screwdrivers, jigsaws and miners, power tools. Power tools are a girl's best friend.
Power tools are a girl's best friend. Yeah, and mine too. That was Ann Reed, and a little lead up into that snippet of an interview that J.D. Doyle did with Ann Reed. This is Queer Voices.
Well, we have a few things to talk about before the top of the hour. And, of course, Ann Reed's going to be at Power Tools on Saturday, October 25th at 8 p.m. And thanks, J.D., for having that interview and letting us know about it. The seating is rather limited. So if you want tickets, you need to call 713-527-9100. Or you can go to her website, which is Ann Reed, ANNREED.com, for more information.
Yeah, and Outsmart, the November issue just out, includes the gayest and the greatest ever, and a couple of the names that you may be here. Anise Parker was named three of the different categories. Fiona Dawson, Bill White as our favorite politician, Dalton DeHart, of course. Ray Hill's name is there, Charles Armstrong. And let's see... several other people here that I...
some of us are just runner-ups.
Some of us, yeah, okay. Yeah, and you were a runner-up, but, you know, you were right behind Ray okay. Hill. What can you say?
And Ray's retired, no less.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, well, early voting is about to start.
Monday.
Yes.
At 8 a.m. And you can get some more information at thecaucus.org. And in fact, you can get the endorsement list there, or you can go to Outsmart and get the endorsement list.
Exactly. And Charles Armstrong will have them at his clubs. So if you're out partying sometime, you can get the endorsement cards there. So you'll be able to, if you don't get it in the mail, you'll be able to take it with you to vote. And don't forget to vote.
David Sedaris.
Mm-hmm.
He started out as doing a little thing on Morning Edition, and one of the things he did was the Santaland Diaries, and this is basically two different things. One is David Sedaris is coming at Jones Hall on Tuesday, October 21st. You can get some more information by calling 713-623-6796, and he's going to be live here. But also, in later this month or soon, at the Alley Theater is going to do a thing called the Santaland Diaries, which is something that David Sedaris did, talking about being an elf at Macy's at Christmas time. And it's really sadistic, I guess is the right term.
Oh,
and it's really funny, and I really want to see that. And we'll try to get somebody on from the Alley Theater to talk about that as we get closer.
And one thing we can't remember, today is Ray Hill's birthday. Happy birthday, Ray!
And you're listening to Queer Voices.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Belinsky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
Hey! Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy. This way.
Sally Huffer is with us from the Montrose Counseling Center, and welcome back. You've been sort of on a little vacation, sort of.
Yes, I have been a little out of touch. So, hi, it's good to be back, albeit at 10 p.m., but I'm glad to be here.
Yes, well, luckily a lot of our listeners can just download it from iTunes and listen to it whenever they want to.
That's what I usually do.
Yeah, so it's easier for a lot of our listeners. So what's going on at the Counseling Center?
Well, what I wanted to talk to you guys a little bit about today is October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And we have a program, the anti-violence program. Domestic violence is one part of that program. But one of the things that I really wanted to talk to you about is, you know, I take some phone calls for the gay and lesbian switchboard from time to time. And I hear from people who are very clearly in a relationship where there's an imbalance of power and control. And what I hear them say to me is, well, I'm not in an abusive relationship because at least my partner doesn't hit me. And there isn't any physical violence. And so I think that one of the things that we think about probably too much is that when we're talking about domestic violence, we focus on physical violence. And I wanted to talk a little bit about other ways that violence, or if we think about it in terms of domestic abuse, what other kinds of abuse is there that can cause an imbalance of power and control? And can you identify yourself if you're in one of these relationships?
I thought it was interesting when I was looking over some of the information of spiritual abuse.
Spiritual
I had never thought of that at all.
Yeah, coercing your partner, either telling them that they cannot practice whatever religious beliefs and attend churches and that sort of thing, or requiring you to attend the same as me is one form of abuse.
Amazing, amazing. And, of course, there's the sexual abuse, and which some of us may know about, but financial abuse.
Financial abuse.
That's,
yeah,
again,
removing the victim's ability to work or restricting the victim's access to money. That's one way that you can maintain control over somebody. Let's see. I also wrote out because my printer at home's not working so well. But there are other types of we kind of know what verbal abuse is, and we can, you know,
been there, done that.
Yeah, we know what emotional abuse is, using rejection and isolation or exploitation to lower your self-esteem. But there's other things that can happen, and especially within the gay community. Let's say your partner coerces you by threatening to out you. This is something that doesn't happen in the straight community. You'll do what I say, or you'll stay with me, or else I'm going to tell your employer that you're gay.
That you're straight. And that wouldn't work out in the real world, would it?
Or I'm going to tell your family. or, you know, I'm going to tell your pastor or your children or your ex-spouse. And that can, that's another way, is using children, you know, to threaten, I'm going to out you to your ex-spouse if you're in divorce proceedings. That way, you know, you may not get custody of the children, that kind of thing. So there's different kind of insidious ways that somebody actually, you know, can end up manipulating a person, even though it's not actual physical abuse.
What motivates people like that? The abuser.
It's hard to say. Some people could say that it's from low self-esteem themselves. We at the Counseling Center provide services, and I want to be very clear about this, that we provide services for the survivors of domestic violence and not the abusers. The reason for that is because we want to maintain a safe space where somebody who is being victimized can come and receive help. If somebody needs therapy to deal with being an abusive partner, there are other places that that person can go. They are gay affirming, but the only place that somebody can go for, because they're a batterer, is, you know, it has to be a battering intervention prevention program, and aid to victims of domestic violence here in Houston is the only place we can refer them. But the victims themselves, the survivors, they can receive services at the Counseling Center.
Do you see a lot of trans people come in for as abused?
We do, and one of the things that people are a little astonished to find out is that domestic violence happens in the gay community at the same rate that it happens in the straight community. And when I say that, it means that one in every four relationships, think of four people that you know who are in relationships. In one of those relationships, there's probably an imbalance of power and control.
And I guess some of us in the community don't recognize that as much because you sort of consider the heterosexual community where it's mostly the male.
Right. There is, you know, that
the power,
standard.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there are a lot of campaigns to shine a spotlight on, you know, men not abusing women, because that is the predominant, you know, what we see most of all is that. But and just to go back just a second, I wanted to say one in four gay, lesbian, bisexual relationships, there's domestic abuse. One in every two relationships involving a transgender person.
Wow, 50% that's incredible.
Involves an imbalance of power and control. And of course, when we're talking about domestic violence, I don't want to leave out the fact that, you know, punching, kicking, slapping, hitting, choking, pulling your hair, you know, pushing, shoving, tripping, twisting somebody's arm, all of those things, those are still domestic violence. But a lot of times it can, you know, manifest in other ways.
And, when I was looking over that and going back to a couple of the questions I had earlier, is that if people are out there are listening, you know, they may not feel they're being abused in certain ways, but it's some of this stuff is insidious.
Yeah.
That they, you know, you don't recognize it until someone else points it out to you.
Sometimes there's something called the power and control wheel. And it was put out by an organization in Minnesota. And they talk about different ways. And I've written some of them down. And I hope you don't mind if I read some of them.
Oh, no. Go right ahead, please.
As I said, about using children, making you feel guilty about your children, using them to relay messages, threatening to take your children, threatening to tell your ex-spouse or authorities that you're gay or lesbian so that they will take away your children. And let me just say, not just gay and lesbian, bisexual and transgender as well. Using privilege, treating you like a servant, making all the big decisions in the household, acting like the lord of the castle, being the one to define each partner's place or duties in a relationship. In other words, saying, well, I'm, you know, the breadwinner, so this, you know, so that means you'll be serving me, that kind of thing. We have minimizing, denying, and blaming. That's making light of the abuse, like saying it didn't happen, or shifting the responsibility for abusive behavior. I had to do that because, you know, I had to slap you or I had to belittle you because you can't clean the house the way it should be cleaned. You can't, you know, do something the way it should be. And so you're forcing me to hit you. Mm. Well, you know, we look at those and we talk a lot to some abusers. They'll say things like, well, I just can't help myself. you know, when I'm around this person, they make me so mad and I just can't help myself. Well, you know, we don't really believe that. You know why? Because when they go out into the real world and they're presenting as a couple and, you know, acting out, do they punch, hit, kick, slap? You know, do they belittle all those things out in public? No, they know better. They know better not to do that in public. So, yeah, they do know better, and they do know how to control it. So, saying it's all your fault, that you deserved it, saying that this is mutual abuse. In other words, well, we're two gay men. You know, we should be able to protect ourselves, so this is mutual. Or saying that women can't abuse women. You know, if only this world were perfect, it would be this lesbian utopia, and we would never, you know, as long as we get rid of the patriarchy, women will never hurt other women. Well, that's not true.
No.
So, using isolation, controlling what you do, who you see and who you talk to, limiting your outside activities. Does your partner read every email that comes in, every text message go over in your cell phone and ask you who every single phone call is from?
Monitors your phone.
Exactly. Using jealousy to control you, making you account for your whereabouts, saying no one's going to believe you because you're gay or because you're lesbian or bisexual or transgender. Then there's using economic abuse, which is preventing you from getting or keeping a job, making you ask for money, interfering with your work or education, using your credit cards without permission, not working and requiring you to support him or her, and putting assets only in his or her name. So those are some ways of economic abuse.
I know a lot of women that are in those situations with men.
Mm-hmm.
Today, I mean, I was, as you were... reading that, I started thinking of women that I know today that are in those kind of relationships.
Sure.
that if you ask them, no, it's okay.
Well, at least he doesn't hit me.
It's exactly.
Exactly.
You know, and my, of course, my response to that is, yet.
Well, exactly, because if somebody escalates to the point of hitting or punching or slapping or, you know, any of those things, chances are that's not the only type of abuse that's going on. Chances are some of these other forms are taking place.
Well, they've been happening a lot longer than
exactly.
that.
Exactly. Now, I did want to talk to people because people might be in various stages of coming out, leaving that relationship. You can come to the counseling center and meet with our anti-violence advocate. And let's say you're not being immediately threatened by your partner.
Right.
Let's say that, you know, you realize about the things that we've been talking about, that this really is an unhealthy relationship, but I don't know how to get out of it because my partner either threatens me if I do or threatens, don't you ever leave me. If you leave me, I'll commit suicide. If you leave me, I have nothing to live for. These are methods of controlling somebody. And so what we recommend is putting together a safety plan, and you can meet with an advocate and talk about what that safety plan entails. Of course, it means making sure that you have copies of all your important documents and that you have them kept at a safe place outside of the home. We also want to remind somebody that if you're in an abusive situation and you need help immediately, we want you to get to a safe place before you call for help. It can be very dangerous, extremely dangerous, if you call for help while your abuser is right there. In the room, in another room. Say you've locked yourself in the bathroom, but you have your cell phone and you want to call for help. Well, you can call 911 and get the police to come out.
Right.
But it will escalate the situation. Your abuser can become angrier with you. So we do ask, try to get to a safe place and then call for help.
One of the problems in going to the transgender community is that most of us don't have any place to go.
Well, and that's another
thing.
There's
no organizations or safe houses for us.
Actually, through Montrose Counseling Center, we do have a program for that. We have what's called scattered site shelter. We don't have shelter that's in a house, per se, but we place people in different hotels and boarding houses and that sort of thing during an emergency period. Let's say, you know, their partner has abused them, kicked them out of the house, or they came home, their partner had been drinking or using drugs and they slapped him but then went back out again, and then they call for help and they're afraid when their partner is going to come home again, or they're afraid to go home and that sort of thing. They can call Montrose Counseling Center, and let me give the number very slowly. 713-529-0037, or you can call Gay and Lesbian Switchboard if 24 hours a day if this happens to you, 713-529-3211. Call those numbers and let them know you need to get into a shelter, or you're afraid to go home, or you're being immediately threatened. We'll get you into, like I said, either a hotel or a boarding house. Now, it's not going to be the Ritz-Carlton, but we're going to get you someplace safe for the time being.
Well, that's wonderful to hear that you have that a possibility for trans people also.
It's
along
very
with
important.
The since they're more likely to be in an abusive relationship.
Well, and
twice as much so.
Of course. And where else can... Well, first of all, if you think about it, if the traditional model is a male abusing a female, and you present yourself at, like, let's say, a women's shelter, if a lesbian goes to a women's shelter and says, my partner is abusing me, you know, I really need help, they'll put her in shelter. Well, let's say the next day, the partner shows up at the women's center and, using that traditional model, says, hey, my boyfriend's been beating me up, I need to get someplace safe. They put the partner in the same shelter, you know, as...
Oh, my.
And so that person is able to get into the system, find out where they are, you know, and once you break free of that relationship, you know, that's when there could be some more hostility. That person can go in and stalk you or harm you and that sort of thing. So we try to get people into their own apartment, you know, first of all, into their own room at the boarding house or the hotel room. That way, if their partner does find out where they're staying, we can put them in a different room. We can put them in
a
different place.
Okay, so what else is going on at the Montrose Counseling Center?
I know. I keep talking about all that. Well, we have recently opened the GLBT Cultural Center, which is on the first floor, and we're very excited about that. We have some new tenants who have been moving in, and so that's great, too. But we also have a lot of groups that are already meeting there. We have... the National Leather Association, Bunnies on the Bayou. We have a World AIDS Day Committee meeting that, you know, meets there on a regular basis. Kindred Spirits is meeting there. And so it's really wonderful to see people coming in and out of the building. What my personal hope is that when we get more traffic through the counseling center, and even if it's just on that floor for the cultural center, that they may see flyers and programs that are going on at the counseling center, and hopefully reduce the stigma, because a lot of people won't seek help because they don't know, you know, that one, help exists in an affirming place for the gay community, and to find out that, hey, you know what, we have a support group for gay men with prostate cancer. You might not have known that, but if you're there and you see the flyer, hey, I didn't know that, wow. You know,
and so how can we get some more information about meeting space or what programs are going on?
You can go to our website, which is www.montrosecounselingcenter.org. And then in the left side navigation, there's a place for the GLBT Cultural Center.
Okay. Great. Sally Huffer, thank you very much for joining us on Queer Voices. And it's nice to have you back here talking about what's going on all the time, because you do it so well.
Okay.
Thank you for coming.
You're listening to Queer Voices.
Maybe it's the last one, maybe it's the one before that, what he done. Maybe it's the high schools, maybe it's the teachers, maybe it's the tattooed children in the bleachers. Maybe it's the Bible, maybe it's the lack, maybe it's the music, maybe it's the crack. Maybe it's the hairdos, maybe it's the TV, maybe it's the cigarettes, maybe it's the family, maybe it's the fast food, maybe it's the news, maybe it's divorce, maybe it's abuse, maybe it's the lawyers, maybe it's the prison, maybe it's the senators, maybe it's the system, maybe it's the fathers, maybe it's the sons, maybe it's the sisters, maybe it's the moms, maybe it's the radio, maybe it's the road rage, maybe El Nino or UV rays, maybe it's the army, maybe it's the liquor, maybe it's the papers, maybe the militia, maybe it's the athletes, maybe it's the ads, maybe it's the sports fans, maybe it's the fads, maybe it's the magazines, maybe it's it's the internet, maybe it's the lottery, maybe it's the immigrants, maybe it's taxes, big business, maybe it's the KKK and the skinheads, maybe it's the communists, maybe it's the Catholics, maybe it's the hippies, maybe it's the addicts, maybe it's the art, maybe it's the sex, maybe it's the homeless, maybe it's the banks, maybe it's the clear cut, maybe it's the ozone, maybe it's the chemicals, maybe it's the car phone, maybe it's the fertilizer, maybe it's the nose ring, maybe it's the end, but I know one thing, if it were up to me, I'd take away the guns. I'd take away the
Holly Near, If It Were Up to Me, from her 2000 CD, The Edge. You're listening to Queer Voices, and what would it be like to go traveling gay in the Muslim world? Interesting. Well, Joan Devlin used to work with us here in the studio, and then she moved off to better things, and she's in Iowa now, where I understand that the fall colors are beautiful. And Joan, go ahead and take it away for us.
Great. We will be talking to Michael Luongo tonight. Michael, are you with us?
I am with you.
Great. And I wanted to start this off. First, your website is called Gay Travels in the Muslim World. Is that also the correct title of the book?
Yeah, that is the correct title of the book.
Great. Well, you know, the title alone is intriguing because I think, and you've talked about this somewhat, our impression of the Muslim world, the Middle East, however you want to describe it, is that there is just no room for gay people. It's not, you know, obviously gay people are there, they're everywhere, but you just wouldn't think of that as a place where you could go visit. It, you know, you think of it more as a dangerous place.
Mm-hmm.
So what kind of prompted you to investigate these destinations?
Well, just like you said, the title is the first thing that intrigues people. They kind of like look at it and they go, huh? I'll tell you, there's a couple different things that had made me want to go visit the Middle East and Muslim countries and looking at it from a gay perspective. I am a New Yorker. I lived through 9/11, and that sparked in me a desire to travel through parts of the world that we might have technically been at war with or that our government felt that we should not be visiting, and kind of promote the notion of travel through peace. At the same time, I kept reading a lot of just the same things that you were mentioning. You know, is there room for gay people? You know, what is homosexuality like within these countries? And what I found really was that it's far more nuanced than the headlines that you read would really indicate. I mean, while there are clearly absolutely horrific things that happen to people, you still had space for homosexuality, space for what might not be defined as gay culture, but for same-sex behavior within the context of these cultures. And we have to remember that, you know, historically it's part of poetry. You're also looking at some cultures, not all, that very much separate along gender lines, and things can happen when people are separated along gender lines.
I wanted to talk a little bit too about 9/11,
mm-hmm.
because you actually have a relative who's a police officer, so you were at ground zero, as you put it, literally while it was still smoking. And
yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, how did that impact your thoughts? Because most of us believe the Middle East is, you know, when you say Middle East, you think Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot more to it than that, isn't there?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the first part of your question is, you know, with 9/11, I mean, it was in New York. Actually, I flew home from Texas the night before, arriving at 2 in the morning from Dallas, the morning of September 11th from a delayed flight. And this trip coming up will be the second time the first time I've been to Dallas since that date, actually, now that I think about it. But the Saturday after, I went in with my brother-in-law, who was a police officer, and worked on a bucket brigade, and that's where you go and you actually dig for dead bodies, and you move the rubble. You hunt for dead bodies, just like you saw on television. That was the last day that people who were related to so-called first responders were allowed to go in and help with the effort. I did a lot of photography, but along with digging and working with the various crews, policemen, firemen, fire people that were there, that was largely male. It was almost an entirely male enclave within Ground Zero itself. And my first thoughts actually were of Beirut. I'd actually never been to Beirut, but I knew, you know, from pictures, from the news, you know, that was my first thought. What is it like to live in a city that has been devastated by war? And I, along with other New Yorkers, became completely aware of that, along with people from Washington. That's something that I like to point out to people who live in the middle of the country, who really have no concept what it is like to live in a city that's been attacked by another country or by another ideology. So that is something that we New Yorkers have experienced that other parts of this country have not. So I always like to point that out. The other thing is, God, I'm blanking on the second part of your question after that. It was quite a... The other part of your question, I'm sorry.
Was also because, so you're in this situation and you would think that would not make you want to go to the Middle East.
How we define the Middle East.
Yes.
Well, I mean, the Middle East is kind of broad. We could use Condé Rice's definition of the greater Middle East, which really stretches everywhere from West Africa all the way to Malaysia, what she calls the greater Middle East, but really almost any Muslim country. The Muslim world is very artificial. This term that I do use in the book, while primarily we're talking about the Middle East in the book, we're also talking about suburban Los Angeles. We're also talking about parts of Africa. We're talking about parts of Europe. We're talking about parts of Asia. So the term Muslim world is a very broad one, rather artificial in the way that the Christian world is rather artificial as a term. But the traditional Middle East, even that is very diverse. Countries like Jordan are very different from countries like Egypt, from countries like Saudi Arabia. So within each country, you know, it's very vast. Some countries do actually have a sort of Western-style gay rights movement. Others don't have anything like that. The book touches on many of these countries, a variety of these countries.
And have you actually traveled to all of these countries, or... was it kind of you went to some of them and then did research? How did you put the book together?
Well, the book, I've traveled to quite a lot of the Middle East and Muslim countries. As a response to 9/11, I've been to Iraq, I've been to Afghanistan, I've been through most of the Middle East. I really do not know sub-Saharan Africa and Muslim countries there or within Asia other than Afghanistan. So Malaysia, Indonesia, those places I've not been to. The book is a compilation. I'm the editor of the book. I write the foreword to the book. I write a chapter on Afghanistan. But there are 17 other men who also contribute to the book. And that gives it a broad geographical spectrum, but also a very broad view of the world from different eyes. Some of the men are Western men, such as myself. Some of them are also Muslim men from the Middle East.
And how difficult was it to get contributions to the book? How difficult was it to kind of put everything together?
Oh, gosh, that was difficult. It was difficult for a variety of reasons. You know, the book was originally published by Hayworth Press, where I was an editor. Technically, Hayworth Press doesn't exist as it once did. It's been bought out by Taylor and Francis now. But, you know, the books that I put out for Hayworth, generally, within a year, I'd be able to get contributions and then get the book edited and then ready for the publisher to do what they had to do. This book was different. It was different because it was much harder to get good stories. The other thing was to get stories that people were willing to write and weren't afraid to write. You have to remember that for some men, it was very difficult for them to write these stories. one of the men who is actually Palestinian, he writes about his time in Saudi Arabia and then coming to the United States as an asylum, on asylum. He was already living here and then applied for asylum. It was really difficult for him to put his name to that story. So this is what I was up against. It took about 6 months longer. I had to do an additional posting and an additional request for stories. But what I did find interesting is that a book that I had done for Hayworth before this, Between the Palms, about a third of that collection, about a third of the submissions were by men who'd visited Middle Eastern countries or Muslim countries, or who'd met men from the Middle East who lived in Europe and were telling that story. So it was more difficult than the other books I put together, yes.
We are talking to Michael Luongo, who is the author of Gay Travels in the Muslim World, and I wanted to ask you, what has the response been to the book?
Well, it's been a varied response in the same way that the book itself is varied. You know, I'll tell you that, you know, almost all of the responses to the book have been very positive. This is, depending on the list that you look at, this is the number one gay travel book in the United States. Sometimes it outsells Dameron.
Wow.
And so it's a fantastically selling book, which tells you that people are very curious about it. It's been out for more than a year, and it is still a top-selling book, top-selling gay travel book. We just sold the rights to it in Arabic to be distributed in the Middle East. So, I mean, all of those things are fantastic. That tells you about the response to the book. What I find very interesting when I'm on college campuses, and I didn't expect this when I was writing the book, a lot of young Muslim women, I don't think that they're lesbian, they don't tell me, but I think that they're women who are young women involved in the Muslim rights movement who come to my events and come to hear my readings. That's not something that I expected. You know, I get a lot of people who are just fascinated by the topic. At the same time, yes, I've had some strange reactions to the book. It's my understanding that the Taliban has produced a website about the book, which
oh, wow.
In a certain way I'm kind of flattered about. It's in Pashto, which is the language of southern Afghanistan, and there was a radio producer from Afghanistan who contacted me because he stumbled across the site. So while that probably is something I should be worried about, to a degree I'm kind of flattered by it. I have had a group of students disrupt one of the things that I did here in New York. But in general, it's been a very positive reaction to the book. I hope actually to be able to do a volume two of the book.
Oh, that was what I was going to ask you. Do you see a volume two coming up anytime soon?
You know, I've got to talk to my publisher about it. I've suggested it. We were currently looking at making sure that we got, you know, different editions of the book in terms of languages out before we conquered that. But I do know that many people have come to me. They have stories. And so there are more stories to be told. Another thing that I think is a fantastic and interesting reaction to this book, and it's a topic that I really want to explore further, there's an enormous amount of, we talk about gays in the military, but there's an enormous amount of gay men and lesbians in war zones who are not part of the military, but that are contractors, that work for the State Department, that work in other capacities for the war effort. And I get contacted, I mean, virtually every week by people like that. So the book has touched people in other ways. Again, rather, I won't say unexpected. I go to the war zones and I know this. But, you know, it's not something that most people think about, gays in war zones beyond the military. And such people are talking to me about possibly doing stories for Volume 2.
That would be interesting because I think, you know, one of the things you talked about is, you know, we all have our preconceived notions based on the information we're given, which, of course, most of the information about the Middle East comes through information about the war.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of interesting to actually look at something that comes from real people dealing with this every day. It kind of shatters your illusions a little bit and gives you a new perspective on things.
Oh, yeah.
Did you find that as you were getting these stories that it kind of change your mind about something?
Well, I mean, a lot of it is stuff that I had known going in and out of these war zones. But I will tell you that if it surprises you where you find same-sex behavior and where... I mean, the more that you look at it, the less that surprises you. I won't say that I've become completely jaded and nothing surprises me. But, you know, there are so many stories and so many stories that aren't told, and I think that we have a certain paradigm of the Middle East. We also have a certain paradigm of the military. In this book, I mean, you know, Jeff Key is a gay soldier who was based in Iraq, who contributes to the book, and he talks about his experiences, you know, trying to communicate with somebody who was obviously a gay Iraqi that he met in the course of his patrols. You know, these are stories that are out there. These are other interactions that are going on. War is absolutely horrible. War is absolutely horrible. But at the same time, you know, there's all these other stories behind the actual fighting, behind the war, and this book touches on that. You know, I think that if we looked at, and I'm not going to say that my book is... anything that should be compared to Rudyard Kipling, for example. Rudyard Kipling writes about the colonial wars that the British were involved in, but it's not really about the wars. It's about the interaction between the British and the people that they occupied, the people that they quote-unquote conquered. So there are all these other rich stories that are going on that aren't really looked at, and that's one of the things that the book does. And again, many of the young people who come to my university talks, they're really fascinated to hear about the lives of ordinary Iraqis and ordinary Afghans beyond simply the war coverage. And so if I'm contributing that, I think that that's great.
And what can people do to get a copy of your book?
Well, I mean, the book is available in most gay bookstores. You can order it on Amazon. You can order it on Barnes & Noble. There's click-throughs for all of that on my website, gaytravelsinthemuslimworld.com. You know, for your Houston audience, I'm going to be in Houston on Thursday, October 23rd at the Central Library at 7. And as I understand it, there'll be books for sale at that time. You know, so there's a variety of different ways that people can get the book. Google my name, Michael Luongo, L-U-O-N-G-O, you know, plus Gay Muslim World, and you'll find a whole bunch of different bookstores that actually sell it. So it's not hard to get. The more you buy, the harder it'll get to be. It'll be to get, but I try not to make it hard to get. And
right.
Hayworth
well,
Press speaking, is the publisher.
We've been speaking with Michael Luongo, author of Gay Travels in the Muslim World. And, Michael, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to be with us tonight.
Oh, I want to take the time to thank you for having me. It was a pleasure. Thanks.
Great. And you are listening to 90.1 KPFT Queer Voices.
What really happened in Mashhad, Iran, on July 19, 2005? We'll look for answers later in the program. Issuing a 4-3 ruling on October 10th, the Connecticut Supreme Court said that gay and lesbian couples in the state were entitled to full marriage equality. While civil unions established by the legislature 3 years ago provided virtually all the rights of marriage except the name, the court's majority decided that such second-class status violated the state constitution's guarantee of equal protection under the law. Bennett Klein of the Boston-based Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders, or GLAAD, was one of the lead attorneys for the 8 plaintiff couples in the case. He addressed the media during a celebratory press conference that day.
Everybody understands that marriage is a unique institution with profound meaning for couples, that marriage is unparalleled in the dignity, respect, and protection that it gives to couples. And with today's decision, gay and lesbian families in Connecticut will now be able to marry and have the same protection and security as all other families in this state.
For most people, this is not a big issue. They don't think about gay people.
Mary Bonato, GLAAD's civil rights director.
What has happened in this state is that ordinary people have come to see these people as people, as neighbors, as co-workers, whether they're teachers or firefighters or whatever. They've come to see them as people who are parents of children in their schools. They've come to see that they worship in the same church or temple. They've come to see these people as human beings with the same inherent dignity that everyone else has. And when you have that recognition, then the question becomes, why is it exactly that only same-sex couples, only these two, are denied a right that everyone else has? And when you start asking that question and you start thinking about the humanity, the answer becomes pretty simple. In this country, we don't have two standards of law. We have one standard of justice for everyone, and that is the principle that the Connecticut Supreme Court vindicated today.
Mary Bonato put it so well that we are going to have outbreaks of happiness.
Ann Standback of the statewide marriage equality group Love Makes a Family.
And I think given the gloomy economic news of the past few weeks, we all deserve many, many outbreaks of happiness. Today, same-sex couples who have made a lifelong promise to take care of and be responsible for each other celebrate being welcomed into one of society's most fundamental institutions. And today, Connecticut can proudly and appropriately claim its nickname, the Constitution State. Thank you very much.
Opponents of the ruling held their own press conference called by the Family Institute of Connecticut. Executive Director Peter Wolfgang noted that even the state's so-called liberal legislature had resisted marriage equality efforts. He called for passage of a November ballot measure that could open the door to a statewide voter referendum on the issue.
This decision is an outrage. Our Supreme Court justices, instead of allowing us to govern ourselves, instead of allowing government, as Lincoln said, of the people, by the people, and for the people, have decided to appoint themselves our robed masters, our philosopher kings. Our judges today have said, you know what, we're going to reach down into the political process and all the really big questions of American democracy, questions about the sanctity of marriage, or on the federal level for many years now, questions about the sanctity of life. The judges will reach down and say, we'll take these really big questions out of the democratic process, and you little people with your elected representatives, well, they can focus on filling the potholes in your streets. There are now three states in the entire 50 United States, only three, that have same-sex marriage, and in all three, every one of them, it was forced on us by the court. There isn't a single state in the land where the people voted for same-sex marriage. But we have one opportunity. There will be a question on the ballot on November 4th asking state voters if they want to hold the Constitutional Convention. This question will not appear again for 20 years. This is our one opportunity to rise up to have something like the remedy they have in California.
For the time being, however, Connecticut becomes the third U.S. state to open marriage to lesbi-gay couples, joining Massachusetts and California, at least until the Golden State's November 4th election results. Some of the Connecticut plaintiffs now get the last words about their historic win.
I'm Janet Peck. This is my partner, Carol Conklin, soon to be my spouse, Carol Conklin, and it's a real thrill to be able to say that. For 33 years, my heart has ached for that moment. And today, I know that that ache is going to now be replaced with tremendous, wonderful joy, and that our love that we felt for all these years will finally be complete. Thank you.
My name is Garrett Stack, and this is my partner, John Anderson. And for 28 years, we have been engaged. We can now register at Home Depot as we prepare for marriage. And as the Supreme Court decision said, marriage is much more than a bundle of rights and responsibilities. It comes to the soul of who we are as human beings. So we are just overjoyed and can't wait for another 28 more if God provides that. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Beth Kerrigan. It's my spouse to be, Jody Mock.
And this is me.
What's your name?
Fernanda. And Carlos.
Words can't express our absolute sense of joy and gratitude to the justices who made our lives that more special. We are just thankful and relieved, quite frankly. It's been a long haul, so thank you all.
I'm Robin Levine Ritterman, and my partner,
Barb Levine Ritterman.
And I'm thrilled that our soon-to-be 11-year-old, who looks at the pictures of the wedding commitment ceremony that we had in 1992 and just doesn't understand why we're not married. There's the pictures. There's the rabbi. Very soon, he's not going to have to, you know, be confused anymore. He's going to understand that his parents are married just like all his friends. So thank you.
I'm Jeffrey Bush, and this is my fiancé, Stephen Davis. And this is our son, Elijah. And we have been together for almost 20 years. And today it feels like our world has changed due to the simplest of things, marriage. After 20 years, it still feels like the beginning, and I'm so looking forward to the rest of our lives together as a married couple. And Eli's going to be our ring bearer.
How the world can change, it can change like that, due to one little word, married. See a palace rise from a two-roomed flat, due to one little word, married. And the old despair that was often there suddenly ceases to be. For you wake one day, look around and say, my lovely boyfriend, or if I were a lesbian, my girlfriend. But I'm not, so my boyfriend,
This Way Out update has been posted on our website. For recent programming information and behind-the-scenes news about your favorite international LGBT radio show, log on to www.thiswayout.org.
Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's 2007 visit to the United States for a United Nations General Assembly meeting was marked by a controversial appearance at Columbia University, where he famously contended that there are no gays and lesbians in his country. While attending this year's UN gathering in late September, Ahmadinejad was interviewed by Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman. That progressive and notoriously unembedded journalist pressed the president on the status of Iran's gays and lesbians and later got a response from activist Kourash Shemirani of Queer Iran Alliance.
When the Iranian president visited New York last year, he gave a speech at Columbia University. He was asked about attitudes to homosexuality in his country.
In Iran, we don't have homosexuals like in your country. We don't have that in our country.
On Wednesday, I asked the Iranian president to clarify his statement.
I didn't say they don't exist. I said not the way they are here. In Iran, it's considered as a very unlikable and abhorrent act. People simply don't like it. Our religious decrees tell us that it's against
all
values, and all divine laws actually believe in the same. Who's given them permission to engage in homosexuality? It's considered as it shakens the foundations of a society, the family foundation. It robs humanity. It brings about diseases. It should be of no pride to the American society to say that they defend
homosexuals.
It's not a good act in and by itself to then hold others accountable for abandoning it.
اتفاقی اسمش آزادی هم نیست.
And it's not called freedom either.
بله، اگر کسی تو خونه خودش در خفا کاری بکنه، کاریش نداره کسی.
Sure, if somebody engages in an act in their own house without being known to others, we don't pay any attention to that.
در محدوده شخصی خودشون افراد کاری میکنن، آزاده.
People are free to do what they like in their private realms.
اما کسی نمیتونه کار خلاف قانون رو در ملأ عام انجام بده.
But nobody can engage in what breaks the law in public.
چرا در غرب همه این مرزهای اخلاقی متلاشی شده؟
Why is it that in the West all moral boundaries have been shaken?
برای اینکه یه عده میخوان رأی بیارن، حاضرن هر کار غیر اخلاقی رو مجاز بشمارن؟
Just because some people want to get votes, they are ready to overlook every morality.
این به ضرر جامعه است.
This goes against the values of the society.
دستور پیامبران الهی است.
It is the divine rule of the prophets.
البته در ایران اینجوری که در اینجا مطرحه در اونجا مطرح نیست اصلا.
And then of course in Iran it's not an issue as big as it is of concern here in the United States.
ممکن افراد معدودی باشند.
There might be a few people.
و ناشناخته.
Who are unknown.
فضای عمومی کشور ما مخالفه با این.
In general our country would not accept it.
و قانون هم هست.
And there's a law about it too.
قانون رو باید تبعیت.
Which one must follow.
July 19th is a day that is honored around the world that where two gay teenagers, Iranian teens, were hung. This is a picture of them hanging. They were two young men named Mahmoud Asghari and Ayaz Marhouni. Do you think gay men and lesbians should die in Iran?
No, ma hamshin qanuni nadarim bara edame inha dar Iran.
No, there's no law for their execution in Iran.
اینا ممکنه قاچاقچی بودن یا کسی رو کشتن.
Either they were drug traffickers or they had killed someone else.
کسانی که افرادی رو بکشن و تجاوز به عنف کنن و ناامنی ایجاد کنن ممکنه مجازاتشون اعدام.
Those who kill someone else or engage in acts of rape could be punished by execution.
والله اونا که همجنسگرا هستن اصلا شناخته نمیشن که بخوان اعدام بشن.
Otherwise homosexuals are not even known who they are to be hung in the second.
ما نداریم مجازات اعدام برای اونها.
So we don't have execution.
کار ممنوعیه، کار زشتیه.
Of course we consider it an appalling act.
اما مجازاتش اعدام نیست.
But it is not punished by capital punishment through capital punishment.
کار غیر اخلاقی است.
It's basically an immoral act.
خیلی کار غیر اخلاقی است، اما مجازات اعدام نداره.
There are a lot of acts that can be immoral, but there's no capital punishment for them.
Now we're joined on the phone by the Iranian-American activist Qudosh Shamirani from Queer Iran Alliance. He's published widely on the subject of how international gay rights advocacy about Iran can face the danger of slipping into pro-war propaganda. Qudosh, welcome to Democracy Now! Your overall response to the Iranian president's comments on the issue of the hanging of the young gay teens.
That has not really been proven. There's been a big debate about that from the human rights organizations about whether they were hung because they were gay. So even, you know, bringing that up with him, I think, was a little tricky. And he was able to dismiss the message. The government has been able to dismiss that accusation easily because the case itself was never brought to light. There's not the facts that are not known. And he, what he basically said that was quite interesting is that he said that, you know, homosexuality or sodomy is not punishable by death in Iran, which is, of course, not true. There is that law in Iran. And in another sense, it is true because there's so many different laws on the books that that negate this one law that he can say that that doesn't exist on the books. I mean, the legal system in Iran is so complicated that you can have a law that says one thing and many laws are negated, and that's the case with sodomy. So in a way, him being forced to say that the law doesn't exist is a continuation of him trying to sort of cover for himself. In the Larry King interview the day before, 2 days ago, he basically said that the government does not go into people's private lives, and people's private homes is their own place. We do not intervene in what they do in their own home, which is again not true. So he's trying to sort of put a nicer face on the various policies and the various things that happen to Iranians in general, gay Iranians in particular. And at this point, I'm not really sure where it's going.
Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman spoke with Qudosh Shamirani of Queer Iran Alliance following their exclusive interview with Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Tanya Kane Perry, Donna Ann Ward, Rex Walkner with Bill Kelly, and Sherry Lund contributed program material. Thanks also to Melinda Tuhus at Free Speech Radio News, and to Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! Alan Cumming sang Married, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is made possible by charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to subscribe to podcasts of your favorite international LGBT radio show. You can also subscribe to CDs or cassettes of our programs and support our work there. To receive our weekly program email alerts, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on KHEN Salida, Colorado, Experiments FM, Ames, Iowa, 3OCR, Colac, Victoria, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT. And Jack, when I was talking with Joan on the phone setting up her interview, she was saying that the colors up there in Iowa have been particularly beautiful this fall.
Oh, I don't understand that. We don't quite have that down.
No, we don't.
Exactly.
Well, actually, you know, I really do, because I'm from Scranton, Pennsylvania, which is like the epicenter of the of the universe of politics right now. Like, everybody's been there 10 times. Although the takeoff on Saturday night was really funny, that basically Biden was saying it's just his arm. Well, it really is. it's like half the size it was at one time. Yes, that the colors were nice in the fall, but it always meant that the damn winter was coming. We want to thank our guest tonight.
Yes, we want to thank Kristen Williams, director of the Transgender Foundation of America Center, one of the first transgender center in the United States here in Houston.
Also, Casey Davis, who was telling her story about her 88 years of life. And then, of course, Sally Huffer from the Montrose Counseling Center.
Yes, Sally's still here.
next week, we are going to be talking. J.D. Doyle is going to do an interview about the Houston Women's Festival, which is coming up. And also Halloween Magic. We have some guests coming on. And Lesbian Health Initiative is talking about their health fair that's coming up. And, of course, next week we also start our fundraiser for KPFT.
So get your checkbook out.
And also October 20th is the first day of early voting. It starts at 8 a.m., goes to 4:30 p.m., Monday through Friday. If you're interested in knowing some of the stuff about voting, you can go to thecaucus.org. There's a whole bunch of information. You can also go to harrisvotes.org. That can give you some information.
And so if you don't know, early vote goes through Friday the 31st.
Halloween.
Yes, Halloween. So you've got that time period now. The understanding is there's going to be long lines possibly, so take your opportunity to get out and early vote.
And if you'd like to get your organization on the radio show, you can give us an email at jack@queervoices.org, because we're always interested in what's going on. In fact, if you got some announcements, you can send it there, too. We're trying to update our announcements of what's going on in the community a little bit more than we have in the past. But we like to have all the information, the who, what, when, where, why, so that we can definitely get all that information out.
Yeah, and thank you for being with us tonight. This is Jennifer Renee.
And this is Jack Walensky.
And Glenn Holt.
Good night.
You have been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston, with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Walensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, Jennifer Renee, Greg Chapman, and Jack Walensky. Be sure to listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
Institute for Culture, The Artery, and KPFT present an important environmental film series on Sundays and Tuesdays, October 19th to October 28th. The Waterfront, which will be shown October 19th, examines water as a human right and privatization of public resources. Everything's Cool will be shown October 21st. It is about the government's failure to take decisive action against global warming. Black Diamonds is about mountaintop removal for coal mining. It will be shown October 26th with Fighting Goliath, Texas Coal Wars. The series ends with King Corn on October 28th, which looks at the pervasiveness of corn in our foods and its environmental impact. The Artery is located at 5401 Jackson at Prospect in the Museum District, KPFT, Houston.
Life is enthusiasm, life is joy, life is love.
The Art of Living Foundation invites you to be part of a unique experience with His Holiness Sri Sri Ravi Shankar. Sri Sri will be conducting the 2008 Health and Happiness Workshop here in Houston at the Crown Plaza on Kirby Drive, October 30th through November the 1st. His Holiness Sri Sri Ravi Shankar is a renowned spiritual leader and humanitarian whose mission of uniting the world into a violence-free family has inspired millions of people worldwide. This is a rare opportunity to meet, heal, and learn pranayama or breathing practices, yoga, and meditation directly from Sri Sri personally. This will be a very popular workshop, so register now to ensure your space by visiting.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.